The Here podcast is all about reclaiming your power and reconnecting with your mind and body. By releasing our stories and the power they have had over our lives and creating a compassionate and supportive community, we can bring love, understanding, awareness, and healing to ourselves and to all who need it most. Join me in saying, enough is enough. I own my power. I am ready for the next chapter of my life, and it will be the most amazing one yet. Content may be discussed that could be distressing to you depending on where you are in your healing journey. If the episode becomes triggering, practice self-care by turning off the episode. If you need to talk to someone, you can always contact your local crisis center or RAIN's national hotline via chat on their website at rain.org or by calling 1-800-656-HOPE. All the links are provided in the show notes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Here Podcast. I love to have you and appreciate so much you listening in on the podcast and hearing all these amazing stories. Today, I have an amazing woman. Her name is Whitley Rogers, and she is a certified health coach. She also is the host of In the Wake podcast. And Whitley herself is a survivor of sexual and mental abuse, struggled with depression and anxiety. So she has a lot of valuable information and things to share. So welcome, Whitley.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Absolutely, I love having you. Where I would love to start is, because I know that you have a story to share, I would love to hear about your story, and then we'll go into how that story led you to doing what you're doing today in the world.
Okay, yeah. So I was in an abusive relationship in my teenage years. I mean, I'm still 19, almost 20, so it wasn't that long ago, but my high school years were pretty rough. It started when I was actually 15. And this boy that I had known for years prior started pursuing me the summer after my freshman year. And I grew up in a religious conservative culture. And we were always taught, like, sex is bad. Don't have sex before marriage. And this is actually where I knew this kid from. He's from my church community. And so I had been going to church with him for years. He was a year older than me and a grade older in school. But he was the most charming, charismatic, popular boy ever. Everyone loved him. Everyone looked up to him. You know, teachers admired him. He was a teacher's pet. Parents loved him. Parents, like, wanted their daughters to date him. Church leaders loved him. He was always in, like, leadership positions in the church. Girls loved him. I lost a lot of my girlfriends when I dated him. And I had a lot of girls that were really mean and nasty to me when I was dating him because they were jealous and they wanted to date him. And so he was well known and well liked, and he wanted me. He started pursuing me. So I felt like wow, he yeah. chose me. So I'm feeling super great about myself. And I was 15. I was just coming out of my freshman year. I had never been in a relationship before. I had just barely gotten my first kiss that summer. Like, I was so innocent and so pure. And I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what a healthy relationship looked like. I didn't know what abusive relationships looked like. And, you know, like, sex and consent, they weren't talked about openly in my church community. And so I didn't have any knowledge or understanding that could have prepared me for this relationship. So I was really going into it really ignorant and blindsided. And it started out really great. I mean, the love bombing and the grooming and all that stuff, you know, the big grand gestures and all these things, but it's also started with these small things that, looking back, of course, are red warning flags, you know, things that I just brushed off and I didn't think were that big of a deal, you know, just weird things like him blowing up and getting super angry that I chose to walk with my friends from school to my car instead of walking with him, or, you know, choosing to go hang out with my group of friends and when I already had plans with them and not canceling those plans to go hang out with him. He would then like stonewall and ignore me or get super mad at me just for these super small things that didn't seem like that big of a deal. And that switch between love bombing and devaluing started to switch between those two, where he would praise me and build me up and make me feel like I was the most beautiful, most prized girl in the entire world. And then these little acts that really broke me down and belittled me and made me feel so worthless, like ignoring me altogether at like church events and not looking at me, not acknowledging my presence, you know, just pretending I didn't exist, but we were dating. And so just these little things that made me feel terrible, but then it just escalated and got worse and worse and worse. And where at the beginning, it was so good. And I'm telling all these people how perfect he is and how he is the best boyfriend ever and makes me feel like $100. I felt stupid once he wasn't making me feel like $100. I felt like I couldn't talk about those things because I had just painted this perfect, beautiful picture. And of course, with social media, you know, our relationship looks so perfect from the outside. We have all these cute little pictures. And I almost think that I was creating this false relationship, this figment of my imagination to convince myself how great it was and to remind myself, like, look, he can be nice. He can do these things for me. So it's fine. It's fine. Like, just kind of discounting the times that he was terrible to me.
Yeah.
And so after, like, we started dating, officially dating, in October when I turned 16. And then that February, when it was our first Valentine's Day together, he did this big grand gesture. And I'm a hopeless romantic and I loved it. But that was just a way to get in my pants. It was never out of love and appreciation for me. It was always because he felt like I owed him something. Like, I just did this great thing for you. Now you owe me something. Now you are obligated to have sex with me because I, you know, I did this. I'm so kind. I'm such a great boyfriend. And this is the least you could do. And it didn't start off with him sexually, like raping me. He started with smaller things and built up to that and pushed my boundaries. And that first time, that Valentine's Day, when he first sexually assaulted me, I was in so much shock and felt so horrible that I avoided him for like 3 days because I didn't know what to say to him. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know whether I should tell my parents. And he, you know, I ended up telling him how horrible it made me feel. And he was like, I'm so sorry. It will never happen again. Whenever I did confront him how these things made me feel, it was always trying to soothe me and throw me breadcrumbs, like acting as if he cared about how it made me feel, but then it just continued to happen anyway. And so it escalated to a point where he was raping me on a weekly basis. And as the sexual abuse just got worse and worse, my mental state deteriorated. So looking back, I can see the timeline and how these things line up and correlate. And that March after that first sexual assault moment happened, I started seeing a therapist, and because my anxiety and depression got so severe and so bad so quickly. Like I probably was predisposed to have mental illness, to have problems with anxiety and depression, because it runs in my family. And I was a fairly anxious child, but I had never experienced these things to this severity and this depth until he started sexually and mentally abusing me. And it was so bad that I was having multiple anxiety panic attacks every day. I missed so much school my sophomore and junior year, and I really am so surprised that I even passed those years because of how much school I missed, because I would be in my car before school just hyperventilating and sobbing, and I wouldn't be able to actually make it into school. Or if I did, I would have a panic attack at school and have my mom come pick me up. Or there were even moments where I literally just walked out of school, and a moment where I had a campus security guard chasing me. Like, I struggled so much with my mental health, and a lot of my anxiety was around the sexual abuse. And I thought that I was going to get pregnant. I was so scared because these sexual encounters weren't consensual. I didn't want them. And so, of course, he wasn't using protection. And when I would bring that up, he's like, it feels better without a condom, and so that's how we're gonna do it. Like, no regard for me and my body and how it made me feel so unsafe and so scared that I would get pregnant. And so, but also, backtrack, I initially did not have the thought of, like, that fear of getting pregnant. He planted that thought very much so in my head, and he would escalate those fears. And every time I would, I don't know, have a stomach ache or a headache or any sign of physical discomfort, he'd be like, do you think you're pregnant? Should we go buy a pregnancy test? Should we go do this? And like, he would make me scared about it. And then he would never actually go take me to buy the pregnancy test. He would drive there, and then he'd go in and come out empty-handed and said, like, I couldn't do it. I was too embarrassed. And I'd be in the car sobbing. And it was just it was exhausting mentally. It was so exhausting to keep up with. And I was just so depressed because he made me feel like nothing. I felt so broken and so dirty and worthless. And, you know, I have a lot of religious trauma too because of my upbringing in this religion and the purity culture and, you know, the beliefs that you shouldn't have sex before marriage. And so I thought I was a licked cupcake. I thought I was damaged goods and that, you know, no one would want me because I was sexually impure. And he used a lot of our church, our religious doctrine and beliefs to manipulate me, would use those different standards or beliefs to his advantage, and would also manipulate them. Like, he would say, well, they just say you shouldn't have sex before marriage because they just want you to have sexual encounters with one person, so it's fine for us because we're going to end up getting married. Oh. And he would drill that in my head that we're getting married, you're stuck with me forever. And he would also fantasize about getting me pregnant and talk about how we would run away together and how we would move to Oregon and how we would have a lake house. And he, you know, would talk about our futures together, and he would, as he was saying these things, like, we're always going to be together, you know, we're getting married. He also, on the other end, drilled in my head that he was the only one capable of loving me, that I was so damaged, I was so broken with my mental illness and with having sex, that he was the only one capable of loving me, and that I was lucky to have him, because after seeing all of this, these low points, all of this ugliness to me, he still loved me, and that he would take care of me. Like, he created this picture where he was the savior in my life, and he also manipulated that picture with my anxiety and depression, and he was a lot of the root causes of my mental breakdowns and my panic attacks. He was always stirring up something, but then he was there, of course, because he caused it. And so then he would jump in and act like my savior and try to soothe me and build me back up and calm me down during my panic attacks. And so from the outside, my family sees that he's always there to pick up the pieces and being there for me. And so then they also have this picture that he's a savior and that he is doing so much for me. And he really manipulated my parents and my family as well. And they are secondary survivors to my abuse and trauma because they were also so manipulated and under his spell as well, that it was so hard for them, you know, snapping out of that spell. And with all of my anxiety and depression, it was also so hard on them and just trying to keep me alive day by day. And it really uprooted a lot of their lives. And my siblings, you know, have a lot of resentments and hurt from that time. And my whole family bears scars. It's not just me. And, you know, they still have their healing to do from this abuse and this trauma. Like, it's not just me. And so he was so powerful in how many ways he had control of my life and of my family. He created these, like, ridges between me and my family. A big key component of the abuse was the isolation and making me dependent on him, because I was super close with my parents. I still am today. And I was, my sister underneath me, who's only 2 years younger, like, we were best friends. And he just created these rifts between us. He used my insecurities against me to cause harm with my relationship with my sister. And he knew my vulnerable points. He knew that I had always compared myself to my younger sister. And so he would compare me to her. He would say super insensitive things. Like, I remember one time he was with my family and I out to dinner, and I don't know how it got brought up, but he said, yeah, my mom wished that I dated Adelie, my sister, instead of you, because she thought she was prettier. Like, he said that in front of my entire family at dinner.
Oh my
and
God.
I felt so humiliated. And so I, like, run to the bathroom because I started crying, because I had always compared myself to my sister growing up. And then he just,
like, used that.
Put salt in those wounds and just ground it in there every chance he got. And so then I, you know, my relationship with my sister was really strained because he was constantly bringing up those insecurities and those wounds. And then with my parents, he knew that I was close with them, and I told them everything. I was super open with them. And so he would lie to them and then make me lie to them, because, you know, I couldn't undermine his truth and I couldn't undermine him in that story. And so that caused some rifts there where I wasn't close with my parents anymore. I started lying to them. I started covering for him and protecting him, and really isolating me from my family, and then isolating me from my friends, where I talked about in the beginning, where he would blow up and get so butthurt if I chose to hang out with my friends or chose to walk with them. And he even went as far, like, I had a best friend back then, and he told me that she was bad for my mental health and that she was the cause of a lot of my anxiety. And I basically burned bridges there and made it so that he was my one person, and I didn't have anyone else to go to. I didn't have anyone else I could rely on. I didn't believe that anyone else loved me. I felt like a burden to everyone else, but he created this savior complex. And that was a big factor in why I didn't leave. And because he really made me think that I was unlovable, that I was screwed if I didn't have him. And so that was a lot of me protecting him, because I was going through therapy during this time. And I didn't mention a single thing about him, about the sexual abuse, about the emotional abuse in therapy, all during those 2 years that I was with him, because I was trying to protect him, because I thought, if I say anything negative about him in therapy, my therapist is going to tell my parents, and then my parents are never going to let me see him again. And so, you know, I was getting help, but it wasn't getting to the root of the issue, because I wasn't opening up about all these things, but I also couldn't see them clearly for myself. And so I couldn't talk about something that I wasn't fully aware of or could recognize. My anxiety and depression was just off the charts the entire relationship, even though I was, you know, having a trial and error process with medication and going to therapy every week. Like, that didn't really soothe anything. It was kind of just a band-aid, and we were trying to figure out, like, what was going on, but we never could, because he was this person always causing all of these problems. And so when he was out of my life, it was like a night and day difference. I like was myself again, and, you know, no longer had these daily panic attacks. I was happier. Just crazy. Crazy stuff. Crazy difference, because he really was this root issue in all of these different problems, which I can see clearly now, but at the time it didn't feel like that. So Sorry, I'm kind of all over the place.
No, you actually, you didn't. You started from point A and went all the way through. You weren't all over the place, not at all. How were you able to get out of that? How did that relationship end?
So it was kind of a messy ending. It was almost 2 years from the beginning, like, grooming phase to the end of actually cutting him off, like cutting him out of my life. But about like over a year and a half into it, he ended things. He broke up with me, and he basically had used me. He'd played with my body, and then he was done with me. Like, I was so broken at that point that it wasn't fun for him anymore. And he ended things, but he was like, ended it in a way that made it him feel good about himself and made him look good to my parents. And he basically, his reason for ending it was that he needed to work on himself for his mission for the church. Like, sexually, he needed to work on himself, and I was just the temptation. I was just a distraction. Oh. So he had to end things, but he was like, we're still going to get married. I'm going to go on this mission, and then I'm going to come back, and we're going to get married. Like, I'm not ending it because I don't love you. Like, I still love you, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't feel like that for me. Like, I could see through that and could tell that it was over and he was done with me. And so I was just broken. I was for 48 hours so suicidal. I attempted suicide 4 or 5 times, and I was just constantly like wailing, screaming, crying for 48 hours straight, because he had manipulated me and planted all these ideas in my head that, like, I would be lost without him, that I needed him, that all of these things. So it felt like my life was over, and I didn't want to live a life without him. I was heartbroken, and attempted to end my life multiple times because I couldn't bear the thought of living without him, because I truly thought that he was my savior, that he was my life raft while I was drowning. But little did I know, he was the anchor. And so after those 48 hours, I knew the end of it. Actually, when he broke up with me, and then he left and immediately went to go talk to my parents to paint his image and, tell his story so they didn't believe me, which is a lot of what he did, is, you know, plant these ideas into my family's head, and that's how he manipulated them. And so near the end of these 48 hours, my parents were pinning me down to stop me from trying to harm myself. My sisters were also there because I was pretty dang strong and escaped multiple times. They were pinning me down, and I'm just crying. And when I'm in the middle of a mental breakdown, I talk a lot, and I just nonstop, all the thoughts that are going through my head are coming out my mouth. And so I'm saying all these terrible things, like, I don't want to breathe. I'll never be loved. I'm so broken. I can't do this. And then something just clicked. I don't know. I was so sick of crying. I was so sick of doing this, because it's like, this isn't working. This hasn't been working. So let's try something else. So this shift happened where all of a sudden I started building myself up, and I started changing my statements. And through the tears, I started saying things like, I am a badass. I can do this. I will be okay. This isn't the end. I am loved. I am supported. I am lovable. And I remember my sisters laughing, witnessing this, because it was probably a really weird thing to experience from the outside, because I've literally been crying for 48 hours and wanting to end my life. And then all of a sudden I was like my own hype woman, and I was empowering myself and building myself up. And it was super weird for them to see, but that moment I committed to learning to love myself again, because I really was a shell of myself after this relationship. My family didn't recognize me. I didn't recognize me. And I had so much self-hatred and self-loathing after all of the gaslighting and the crazy making and the manipulation. I wasn't a fan of myself. And so I committed to learning to love myself, learning to tolerate and accept myself, and making my mental health my first priority. Because I had hit rock bottom. It was so bad. And I was like, I have to devote myself to myself, to this inner work. And I did that. I made my mental health my first priority. It trumped anything else that was seemingly important. I started applying the things that I was learning in therapy. I started opening up about what was really going on. I did all of these challenges, these self-love challenges, to try to retrain my thoughts and retrain my brain. And he tried through this. It was like a couple months before I actually officially cut him out of my life, after that initial breakup, because he was still trying to control me, even though he had broken up with me, and he was still trying to control the narrative that I was telling, and that my parents believed, and that everyone else believed. And I didn't know, but he had already started dating someone 2 weeks after we broke up. We had been together for almost 2 years, and he already had moved on. But I didn't know that at the time. And he's just kind of using me as this side chick. And he would ignore me. He wouldn't talk to me. But then when he wanted access to me. He wanted attention. He'd come to me and then, you know, like, leave me hanging. And it was this back and forth, and I was sick of it. And I gave him this ultimatum, and I was like, look, you have to commit to actually working on yourself and respect my boundaries. And I don't fully remember all of my conditions, but I was basically like, you need to choose. You can either choose to be in my life if you're going to abide by these things and actually follow through with what you originally said, because, you know, contradicting himself majorly. And then when I called him out on contradicting himself over and over, you know, the gaslighting and making me feel crazy and like he had never said those things initially. And so it was either that or I'm going to choose to cut you out of my life and cut all ties and contact, because I can't keep doing this. I can't keep doing this middle state where you're using me when you want to, but then, you know, I'm nothing else to you. And he said, like, give me some time to think about it, and basically strung me along for like another month or so and never giving me an answer. And finally, I was just like, I'm sick of this. I'm choosing for you. Like, I'm cutting you out of my life. This is ridiculous. And he kind of backtracked. Like, a week after he broke up with me, we, of course, weren't talking. And he calls me at, like, 3 a.m., basically crawling back. And wanting me back and saying how much he missed me and, you know, all these things. And he was like, you seem so happy without me. And he was actually getting angry about that, the fact that I didn't need him. And I, in that moment, I even said, I was like, it shouldn't be like that. Like, you should be happy for my happiness. And I shouldn't need you. I should want you in my life. But you shouldn't be angry that I am becoming self-reliant and independent and happy. Like, that's messed up. And I called him out on that, I remember. But he, you know, he'd come crawling back. And then I'd give him this ultimatum. And then I'd cut him out of my life. And then even after that, he was still trying to control me. He had sent me this 15-page letter. And then, sorry. And then he had also sent a letter to both my mom and my dad. And it was just this bogus stuff about how I needed to forgive him and how he even, like, used manipulation with, like, church religious stuff, saying, like, I talked to the bishop and he says that you need to forgive me and that we should make up and that we should still be friends, but he says that it's probably better for me to date someone else. Like, he was just pulling all the things in this letter, and it just went on and on. But it wasn't a genuine apology. It wasn't accountability or owning up for the ways that he had hurt me. It was, again, trying to control how I felt, what I was doing, and how I viewed him, and all these things. But I was months detached from that relationship, and so at that point I snapped out of his spell, and I could see right through it, and I was like, no, I'm not falling for this again. Like, I'm done this time. My dad didn't even read the letter from him because he was just so sick of it. And I didn't realize that it was sexual abuse until months after the relationship ended.
I actually wanted to ask you about that. I have that. I jotted that note down because I think, and I remember I was in an abusive relationship when I was a teenager as well. And you were mentioning that you were you're new at relationships, new mm-hmm. at, you know, sex and sexuality, new at all of that sort of thing. So how, and I think that's very important for others, especially I know that I do have teens that listen to the podcast as well, to understand what is sexual assault, because when they could see, well, I said, okay, let's go ahead and do this, whatever this mm-hmm. is. So, how can I say that that person's sexually assaulting me? Like, when, like, to identify that, I think that would be, yeah. and just so the audience doesn't think that I'm totally insensitive, Whitley did say to me before we started recording that if that I could ask these types of questions. But of course, Whitley, if at any point you're like, no, I don't want to answer that, that's totally fine.
No, thank you for asking. So, yeah, I did not fully realize that it was sexual assault and rape until months later. And I think that's a very important point that, you know, survivors of sexual abuse sometimes don't realize until, you know, weeks, months, sometimes even years later. An example of this, I remember when I first shared my story of abuse openly, I had a 60-year-old woman come to me and she said, I was also raped in high school. And that's the first time I've ever said that out loud. Oh, and that's the first time that I realized that it was rape and that it wasn't my fault. And you sharing your story and the things that happened to you, it brought up all those memories and made me realize, like, oh, that's what it was. And so it can take a long time before you realize what it is. I was slowly opening up in therapy. It was very hard for me to talk about the things that he had done to me mentally and sexually. But luckily my therapist had a lot of background in domestic violence and sexual assault and had worked at an organization prior, so she was able to slowly realize. She didn't come out and say, like, hey, you were sexually abused. She kind of allowed the process to unfold and allow me to come to that realization, because I probably would have gotten really defensive and like felt attacked her just telling me that. So as I started to learn more about these things, as I started to talk about them more, well, first of all, once I was out of that relationship and I started making friends again, and I was kind of waking up to the world again, not in his manipulation, his spell of him always telling me what the world looks like. I was seeing what healthy relationships actually look like and what unhealthy relationships look like, and experiencing what my new friends' relationships looked like and what was okay and not okay. And I slowly started having these realizations, like, oh, it wasn't okay when he didn't listen to my needs and my cries and my me saying no, that I didn't want to have sex with him, like, or oh, it wasn't okay for him to pin me down and spit loogies in my face. Like, that was not okay. That was abusive and made me feel a certain way, and I shouldn't feel that way with a significant other. And as I started having these realizations, I started educating myself and reading books and listening to podcasts about abuse and about sexual assault. And I wanted to know what it was, to see if that is what was happening to me. Because I didn't have the vocabulary and the understanding of those things to be able to label it and to know what was happening. I didn't have that education. And I remember I was listening to a podcast about rape myths, and they were kind of going through, and they were like, you can be sexually assaulted by a significant other. Like, it's not just in a dark alleyway by a stranger. Like, it can come from your husband or your boyfriend, and it's any sexual advance that you didn't consent to, you weren't comfortable with, you didn't want. And then they talked about coercion and how coercion and consent play hand in hand, and how even if you said okay, or you said yes after lots and lots of pressure and pleading and coercion, and because he would say things like, you would do this if you loved me, you would have sex if you loved me, these manipulating things. Because when I had said no, he would play all those plays and coerce me into maybe giving a little bit or giving in a little bit. So I had listened to this podcast, and then I had sent it to both my parents, and I was like, I find this really interesting. You should listen to it. And I remember, like, going out to my car and my dad following me, and because he had just listened to it, and I said the words out loud for the first time, and I was like, I think I was raped. I think I was sexually abused. Like, none, I didn't want that. I didn't want any of that to happen. And he didn't listen to me, and he just kept doing it over and over again. When I even when I would pipe up and voice that I hated this and I didn't want this and plead with him, and my dad's response was so amazing. I'm so blessed to have the most loving, understanding, supportive parents, because his immediate response was, I believe you and I'll support you in whatever you need moving forward to heal from this, and whatever action you want to take or you don't want to take, I will support you through all of it. And that was just, oof, the best kind of thing I could hear. After being gaslit and manipulated and controlled for so long, to be believed and that my reality was true, you know, be validated. Mm-hmm. And so then I went to therapy that week and said it out loud again. And, you know, she just said to me, like, I know, honey. And, like, she knew it. And then my parents realized it and I opened up to them. And as I started to realize what abuse looks like, what sexual assault looks like, I started to have vocabulary to describe what happened to me, and I started being validated, and I started to understand these things, and it has been the most healing thing to just educate myself and to know what abusers look like, what tactics they use, what, you know, these different definitions encompass. And I actually ended up writing out my story in like 18 pages, just kind of the outline of how the sexual abuse just got worse and worse, and what it looked like and what it felt like, and a few instances of mental abuse and the things he was drilling in my head and telling me. And I wrote this all out in some gruesome detail. And I shared it with my parents. It was so hard for them to read because they had no idea how bad it was. And my dad didn't sleep for a couple days after reading it because he was so angry, and they were feeling a lot of guilt that, you know, it was happening under their noses and they didn't know, and feeling like it was their fault. And especially my dad, he felt like he had failed me as a father, that he hadn't protected me. And, you know, I'm his first child, I'm his first daughter. So for this to happen with his first daughter terrified him, having two more daughters after that. And my parents especially have had to go through doing their own therapy and doing their own healing to also heal from this trauma and this huge betrayal and manipulation. And my mom has a lot of trust issues now, and she really struggles, like, trusting my sister's friends and my sister's boyfriend, and, like, it's been really hard on all around, on everyone around me. I don't know if I answered your question.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, absolutely you did. I'm so happy to hear that your parents responded in such a beautiful way. And even you had just mentioned this, but how impactful it is that they went and found, they went to seek out their own therapy instead, and allowing you to have your space to still heal from what you are experiencing, instead of kind of projecting what they were feeling onto you, because I know that could lead to a lot of guilt and for the survivor. So that's beautiful that they did that. And you, so first of all, I applaud you. I am so, sorry for what happened to you, and applaud your strength and how you turned that around. I'm just listening to you share your story and the things that you're saying, like rape myth, survivor complex, grooming, like you you just know so much and you just are so incredibly strong and such a powerful force. And I think that that's just beautiful and amazing. Because I definitely want to know the different suggestions and different things that you did to educate yourself, I wanted to mention a couple of things. So coercion, I'm so glad that you mentioned that, because mm-hmm. that is so incredibly damaging and you wouldn't think so. And even for yeah. young men out there who maybe aren't even thinking of it in that way of being coercion, it's if someone, male or female, is mm-hmm. not ready, they're not ready. And no right. one owes anybody else their body. For mm-hmm. crying out loud, he gave you a nice Valentine's Day. Okay, I'm going to give you some nice, like, I'll get you some chocolates and stuff. And, make, you know, this, right. it's not my body that's in, you know, that would be an exchange. And your body is your body. You are in control. You have that power over your body. And if you're with someone who is trying to, hey, if you love me, and I know this happens all the time, I know it happened to me mm-hmm. too, you would do this. That just needs to stop. And if someone's yeah. doing that to you, for anybody who's listening out there, be like, look, that needs to stop or we're done. Because, you know, feel that. I'm just trying to inspire you to feel empowered to say, no, that I'm not digging it. And if that person doesn't like you because of it, bye-bye. That is I know it happened to me and I know it happens all the time. So I'm really glad that you brought that up. And I really like as well, I told my daughters this from when they were very, very young, so they know this, that you can want someone, but you don't need someone. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you brought that up as a red flag. And even for, you know, just like people themselves, that if you're feeling this tremendous, like, I need this person to be happy or to survive, that's something that internally you need to look at and work through, because you can want yeah. somebody, but you do not need someone to be happy, to be fulfilled mm-hmm. or anything. I'm just so glad you shared that. And one thing, again, I wrote a paper on virginity. And then, so when you said the purity culture, I feel like I'm just talking to someone who has this doctorate in all of this stuff. I had never even heard of that. It was something when I was in graduate school, I was so obsessed with. And one of the reasons that it was at the top of my mind is when I was growing up, we did not live in a religious culture. My household wasn't religious, but mm-hmm. I was aware of religion. And even in just movies that aren't religious, there was things about virginity and about when you lose your virginity and how virgins are pure and how special that moment is when right. you lose your virginity and you bleed. Okay. Right. So I was 11 and it wasn't anything that I could control, but I grew up with that, even just through media, through movies, through what I was hearing, that I was damaged, like you said, a licked cupcake, mm-hmm. that I would never like it's even important. I mean, I can see how it's not, but how important they make it, like you would bleed your first time with your husband. I would never do that, and that right. I would be so damaged. So the fact that you mentioned that, it's so important. I talked to someone, and then I'll be quiet for so you can talk. I interviewed someone the other day who she's doing things in her church to make sex and sexual abuse a part of the conversation. So she created an organization within her church. And I just think that's so incredibly important. I wish every single church and place of worship and just every place would have this, because especially for someone, if you are religious, that's your place that you go to seek, you know, wisdom and comfort and mm-hmm. knowledge and guidance. So there has to be this conversation within our religious organizations and institutions. And I mean, I won't go on a tangent, but I strongly believe we need to look at that a little bit more. I think if you want to be someone who doesn't have sex until you're married, awesome. I mean, I used to work with a guy, such an amazing guy, and him and his wife were doing that. They, you know, they were saving themselves for marriage, and it was beautiful. And if you're not, like, I just want to remove the value of a woman based on if her hymen is intact or not. Like, I just, mm-hmm. I want that conversation to go away. If you want to promote, you know, not having, I mean, it's not having unprotected sex, or if you're someone that really feels like, no, I want to save myself for marriage. I just want to make that clear. Like, I'm not bashing that.
Right,
I just
right.
don't think that it should be held as the pure and the right and the good, and anything
right.
else is lesser. Whew. I really... You just said so much, and I was just taking notes, but I just thank you for bringing up all of those things.
Yes, of course.
And you mentioned love bombing, and I don't, is that the, where he builds you up, makes you feel like you're amazing, and then cuts you down? Is that what that is?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Where it's just like, abusers don't abuse 24/7.
Yes.
And especially at the beginning, because if you went on a first date and they're like calling you these terrible names, you're not going to go out with them again. I mean, I hope not. So the love bombing is just being overly affectionate, just over the top, and being so kind and so generous and so loving to you. And then it's like a switch, and then they devalue you and belittle you and, just are terrible and abusive, and it just switches between the two, because the love bombing is to like reel you back in, and then they abuse you, and then they have to, like, it's like throwing you little breadcrumbs in between the abuse.
Yeah, they could tell you, "I'm sorry," and you're like, "Well, he did love me in this and this and that way, so maybe he or she is sorry," you know? So, oh, that makes a lot of sense. I want to talk to you about your podcast. So I'm 43, and the first time I shared my story in its entirety was a few months ago on my second mm-hmm. episode. I'm so impressed with the fact that you recognized and you did your self-healing, you recognized what you needed to do, and now you are sharing with the world, and you're 19. That is so awesome. I always felt the reason I started this podcast was because I wished and hoped that I wanted to do whatever I could so that I could interject along that journey to help people discover their healing journey earlier. So they didn't live with it. I just struggled and kept that shame and that secret into my 30s. And I love that you're like, nope, I'm putting this out there. And now you're helping other people heal, other people recognize that sooner. I think it's so awesome. And I'd love to hear about when you started your podcast and what you're doing with that podcast.
Yeah. So I started sharing my story first on social media. I started by simply sharing my struggles with anxiety and depression. And that's where my ties with this foundation and the stigma are. I shared it through them, and I took off that filter because I concealed and hid my mental illness and the abuse so well. No one knew I was struggling besides the people that lived in my home and maybe the few extended family members. I mean, I didn't have friends, but like at that time when I was with him, but the people at school, they had no idea. All the people that followed me on social media, they had no idea. I always was making excuses as to why I missed so much school. And I just hoped that no one would notice that much. But I had painted this pretty picture on Instagram that my life was so perfect. My relationship was so perfect. And I was exhausted by keeping up that image. I was so sick of it. I was sick of scrolling through social media and seeing other people's perfect image. And
Yeah.
And their highlight reel and comparing myself to that. And it was really damaging to my own mental health. And so I was like, I'm going to break this. I'm going to share my story and be real about the ugly, the bad side of the struggles, you know, instead of just these happy, perfect, fun things. So I started with sharing my mental illness story and had the most amazing response, and just everyone so supportive and loving, and a lot of people opening up to me about their own stories of anxiety and depression and mental health struggles. And and so then when I started having this understanding of my abuse and the vocabulary for it, I was like, I'm going to do a part two, and I'm going to share my story of abuse on social media. Because I had this overwhelming moment where I kind of just realized that I felt like the reason why I survived all of these suicide attempts, the reason why I survived this abuse and this severe mental illness, was so that I could speak up about it, and so that I could share my story and share my voice and use my voice. I felt like that was the reason I was safe and protected and lived.
Yeah.
Instead of being successful. And I just had this, it was an overwhelming moment with so many feelings, but so much peace and clarity and surety that was my purpose and that was my calling in life. And so then I really devoted myself to sharing these things and speaking up and being an advocate. And I shared my story of abuse through another video, part two, after my mental illness video. But I wanted to continue opening up. I wanted to continue talking about these things. So I was like, I'll start a podcast. And that's where that idea grew. And I have continued talking about, you know, my mental health struggles and my self-reflection and, you know, different avenues of self-help and my abuse and healing from that. And then also bringing on interviewees and interviewing them about their stories and their experiences with these same things I'm passionate about, and really educating the people in my life, in my circles, on my platform, and putting faces to the experiences, putting faces to these words, you know, rape, depression, sexual assault, anxiety. And when you know someone close to you that's affected by these things, it becomes more serious, and you take it more seriously, and you begin to understand these things. And so putting a voice, I guess, on the podcast, putting a voice to these stories, to these experiences, really helps open people's eyes. And I think it's a really beautiful thing to be able to talk about not only the good, but the good, the bad, and the ugly, and all the things, all the feelings.
All the things. Yeah, because the more, so beautifully said, and the more that we do this and that people share, it opens up. Well, first of all, I have a problem with doing that. I never complete a thought. So I have too many thoughts coming in and I want to say them all. It opens up the conversation so that people do not feel ashamed, because mm-hmm. they don't feel alone. And then right. the more we talk about these things, the more people will talk about these things, and the more people will learn. Mm-hmm. Other people, even people who have not experienced any type of sexual violence or abuse, they, you know, like you were just talking about, you know how many parents are going to hear your story and they're going to learn things. They're also going to learn, oh, this is how it affected Whitley. let me just be a little bit, have my eyes a little bit more open to my kids. Not that they're not caring for their kids, but more open to the signs. What do the signs look like? All the different ways that that sexual abuse can happen, the different circumstances, you know, because people have this idea of what it looks like, you know, or who is a perpetrator. And by sharing our stories, it increases the knowledge and the understanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is,
and especially
awesome.
When you have those ideas of what it should look like or what it does look like, mm-hmm. you're gonna miss the experience. They're gonna happen right under your nose,
yeah.
Because you're like, oh no, not him, not my child, not.
Oh, he's a leader in the church and he's going on a mission and not obviously just not that religion, but in general, you could put that in any, you know, religion or circumstance, or he has straight A's and is the star football player, or, you know, not just to make it about, males, how about she has straight A's and she's, you know, an honor student. I don't know any. You get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There's no face. Of an abuser. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you go about, just want to ask you, I want to be respectful of your time, educating yourself? Did you just read and listen to podcasts and like what, or and if it's all of the above, any suggestions that you have for people, listeners that want to start educating themselves?
Yes. So, it probably started with this book that I was given by given to me by a friend, and it's called "Why Does He Do That?" by Lundy Bancroft. And he does talk about in there like LGBT circumstances and how women can also be abusers, but that's just the title. But he is a therapist that has worked with thousands and thousands of cases of abuse of abusers, and he's really studied the abuser tactics and mindset. And so it's called "Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry and Controlling Men." And he really dives deep into, you know, like what's going on in their mind, why they do these different things, and the different tactics of abuse and healing from abuse, like safety planning. It's a really good book. Basically, my entire book is highlighted because I learned so much from that. And so then I multiple books after that about narcissistic abuse and mental abuse and healing from these things, and also I started listening to podcasts, researching the different topics that I was passionate about, and then also following I hate to call them influencers, but people on Instagram that openly talk about these things and their experiences. And once I started opening up about them, different friends and family members and strangers started opening up to me about their experiences and their stories. And it's really just reading, listening, and sharing. But I mean, listening to podcasts, but also listening to other people's stories. So yeah, I don't know. Lots of different things.
That's great.
Educated myself.
That's great. And this book that you love, you know, something I want to do, when this episode goes live, I'm going to give away one of these copies of this book that made such an impact on you.
I know
of them, that books made such an impact on me, and it's something that you can, you know, when you're starting your journey, even if you're not super comfortable talking, just being able to have that resource. So I'm going to do that. That's that. Thank you so much for sharing all that. I'm also going to read that book because I have not before.
It's so good.
Whitley, you are amazing, and you have just covered so much. I have so many notes of things that I want to even research more about and understand more, because even for me, even though I'm 43, I really started my healing, really digging into my healing in my late 30s. And that's when I really felt strong enough, honestly, to confront everything that had happened. So I have a lot of learning to do, even on terms and different things like that. So I learned so much from every single guest that I talk to, and that absolutely have learned a ton from you. I know that you are going to be incredibly inspiring to so many people. So where can listeners find you if they want to continue to be inspired by you? Because I know they will.
Thank you. So I do have my own podcast called In the Wake. And my website is just whitley.com. And same with my Instagram. It's just Whitley. So if you know how to spell my first name, you should be able to find me.
I'll put all the links so they can find you. Awesome. And how lucky is that? That's awesome.
Pretty nice.
All right, wonderful. So In the Wake, wherever you love to listen to your podcasts, whitley.com, and it's W-H-Y-T-L-I-E, but I will have it in the show notes. I will have it, you know, on my webpage under resources that I'm building out. So you'll be able to find her easily. Whitley, I enjoyed my time so much with you today. I want to make sure, is there anything else, any parting words that you would like to share with the audience before we part ways this evening?
Yes, thank you. I just want to reiterate that you're not alone in whatever you're going through and whatever you're experiencing. I know in the thick of it, it feels like you are alone and you're the only one that has ever felt this way, but that's so far from the truth. And also that, you know, if you have a significant other, if you have a boyfriend, a husband, a wife, it does not mean you owe them sex, does not mean you owe them anything. Just because you're dating, just because you're married, doesn't just mean they own your body. You still have say over what's okay and what's not okay and what you like and what you don't like. It's not just, once we're officially dating, free reign. Like, it doesn't work like that. You still have say. And that also, if something does happen to you, if you are sexually assaulted, if you are abused, it's not your fault. No matter how much they try to make you feel like it's your fault, or that you caused it, or you brought it upon yourself, or other people, outside people, maybe even family or friends, no matter what anyone says, it's not your fault. You did not bring it upon yourself. I think that's probably what I'd say.
And that's beautiful and incredibly powerful. And I also want to add on to that, those words were incredibly powerful. Even as a wife and a 43-year-old woman, my husband never makes me feel this way, but I will. So if at any moment I am telling myself, we haven't slept together in a few days, I owe it to him. I'm his wife. Yep. I immediately, I'm triggered. I immediately, my body shuts down. And he never makes me feel that way. But that coercion you were talking about. Mm-hmm. And once that happens to you, it's almost like in my DNA to where whenever I start to think that way, and not even negative, it could just be slight, like any type of feeling of, I should. I immediately go to that place where I'm triggered by that. So that was even very powerful for me, that just reminding ourselves that we don't have to, it's that we don't owe it in no matter what, and that we I just really appreciate that. Thank you for saying that.
Of course.
Whately, you are amazing, and what an incredibly powerful and wise soul. I am so looking forward to continually following and listening to your podcast, keeping in touch with you. Thank you so much for this beautiful conversation this evening.
Thank you for having me on and giving me a space to share. I really appreciate you and what you're doing. It's beautiful.
Absolutely, anytime. Have a beautiful, beautiful rest of your week.